Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
From WNYC in New York, this is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. Hey, have you heard the new Arcade Fire song yet? It was released on Tuesday and came with not one, but two music videos, although the one that everybody's talking about is the interactive one that was shot in Haiti. In fact, I was just talking about it here in the studio with the award-winning Haitian-American novelist Edwige Dantica. She's here to share a few tunes with us and was telling me that she knows the town where they filmed the video. She also knows Regine Chassin, the co-founder of Arcade Fire, because Regine's family is from Haiti, too. Anyway, we'll talk with Edwige about her latest book and her music picks in a bit, but if you haven't heard that Arcade Fire song yet, here's a taste. That's Arcade Fire's new song, Reflector. You can hear Wynn Butler singing and Regine's voice, too. And there's a third voice there, that of an early Arcade Fire fan named David Bowie. No doubt about it, Arcade Fire is popular, right? I mean, yeah, they don't have a million-selling record, but people know who they are and they've got all these awards, so doesn't that make them popular? Well, one of our guests has written about how we've had to redefine what popular means in an age when everything can be popular. But before we get to all of that, let's start with a song. Our musical guest is Laura Mvula, the British singer and keyboardist who has become hugely popular, whatever that means these days, on the other side of the Atlantic. Her debut album, Sing to the Moon, is now out here in the States, and she's going to play a song to get us started. Here's Laura Mvula with She, live on Soundcheck.
She walked toward you with her head down. She wondered if there's a way out of the blue. Who's gonna take her home this time? She knew that this time wouldn't be the last time. She waits looking for a savior, someone to save her from a dying self. Always taking 10 steps back and one step forward. She's tired, but she don't stop. She don't stop, she don't stop. No, she don't stop, she don't stop, she don't stop. Every day she stood, hoping for a new light. She closed her eyes, then she heard a small voice say, you don't stop, no, you belong to me. She cried, Maybe it's too late. She don't stop, she don't stop, she don't stop. She don't stop, she don't stop, she don't stop. She don't stop, she don't stop, she don't stop. She don't stop, she don't stop, she don't stop, no, no. She walked toward you with her head down. She wondered if there's a way out of the blow. Who's gonna take her home this time? She knew that this time wouldn't be the last time.
That's Laura Mvula with her song, She. We'll hear more from Laura here in the studio with a special stripped-down acoustic set later in the show. The Haitian-American novelist Edwige Danticat won a National Book Critics Circle Award for her 2007 memoir, Brother, I'm Dying. Then in 2009, she was awarded the MacArthur Genius Grant, and now she returns with a new novel called Claire of the Sea Light. The book is set in a seaside town in Haiti and centers around a young girl, Claire, whose mother died in childbirth, and her fisherman father hopes to give her a better life by sending her to live with a local successful shopkeeper. But before he can make a decision, she disappears. Edwige Danticat joins me here in the Soundcheck studio to talk about the new book and to share a playlist of some of her favorite music in our occasional Pick 3 series. Edwige, welcome to Soundcheck.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So Claire of the Sea Light is, this is almost, it's a lovely, small, intimate novel, but it's also kind of a chamber opera of sorts with all these, you know, characters giving you different views, points of view of the same city and the same set of events.
Mm-hmm. It's a collage à clé, as one of the characters calls it. I imagine the reader landing in Villerose, the fictional town where the novel is set, and just being on the beach and hearing all those people, meeting the different characters. It is centered around Claire in this pivotal moment of her life, but you also feel like you're a visitor in this seaside town, and you're meeting all these different sort of heads of the town.
Mm-hmm. There's a radio station that mm-hmm. figures prominently in the story. There is a woman who's running a talk show on the radio station who's also trying to write mm-hmm. a book, mm-hmm. which she, I think you refer to it as a choral piece.
Yes, yes.
So there's, I mean, you know, do you listen to music? Is music on your mind or in your ear when you're writing?
Music is not in my ear when I'm writing, but I always think of the music of language, of the music of poetry and of the town. For example, you know, there's a way that people speak back and forth. Even in Haiti, the people who are selling things in the market will speak, or people who walk through the neighborhoods. So you'll have a vendor walking through and saying, machin patate, machin patate, machin duri, machin patate, machin d'lo, machin d'lo. And just the singing is a way of attracting business. So the musicality in everyday life, and of course Haiti has extraordinary music, wonderful musician, but I'm also as a writer, interested in the musicality of everyday life, how people relate, the poetry of everyday language.
Is that why there are numerous phrases and sentences that are in both Creole and English in the book?
Absolutely. Also acknowledging the fact that there'll be people reading the book who read both Creole in English, but there are musicians too, in the or aspiring musicians in the book. The rappers mm-hmm. who send their CDs to the radio host in the book, who are also trying with the daily grit and poetry of Creole rap to try to talk about their lives, the danger, the precariousness, or all the things that they face in their lives. So Creole rap, which is probably the closest we get to an immediate reportage mm-hmm. about a harsh realities in Haiti, also figures in the book.
Right. And as do these sort of traditional circle songs. Is it, mm-hmm. did you say
Worn, yes, actually, yeah. It's. I'm so glad you brought that up, because I am on a music show. Because one of the things that I wanted to also show in the book is sort of the circle. Like, as I mentioned, when you talk about the everyday musicality, Worn is like a Ring Around the Rosy game where children hold hands and run in a circle and sing some songs. And one of the writers, you know, I have an epigraph from Dean Toomer. I always loved how he used poetry, but also a kind of sing-song in between blocks of traditional narrative, the long narrative. So the worn is an essential part of it. And the book, in a way, is almost structured like a worn, because we keep coming around in a circle to the story, just the way these little girls are doing on the beach, holding each other's hands and telling a story through these songs of the worn.
Mm. So Edwige Danteca, the novel is called Claire of the Sea Light. It is a book without explicit music in it, but somehow very musical because of all the things you're talking about, the play of words and the interplay of the different characters. But let's actually talk about some music. You've picked three songs for us today. The first of which is an artist called Martha Jean-Claude. Mm-hmm. Who is she?
Well, Martha Jean-Claude is an actress, writer, singer who was born in Haiti. And then when she wrote a play for which she was arrested and when she...
When was this?
This was in 1952 when under a president called Paul Magloire. And her daughter was born almost 2 days after she was released from jail. And then she moved to Cuba with her journalist husband. And she started singing in Cuba. She traveled to Angola, to Mexico, but these songs always went back in some ways to Haiti, whether through the musical styles or the words. So this first song, Nostalgie Haïtienne, is about a letter from a mother in Cuba to her neighbors in Haiti, who says, look after the children, take care of them, and when I come back, I'll buy some land, I'll buy a goat, I'll buy a cow. So it encompasses this nostalgia about Haiti, but also this need that some people have, this lack of choice almost, that they have to go elsewhere, in this case to Cuba, to work and make a living at the same time that they leave family back home that they are sending messages to.
Let's hear the song from Martha Jean-Claude called Nostalgie Etienne.
Voilà qu'on paye vin fond l'aide pour moi. On baille la caille à conti paquet. T'en prie souple, dit qu'on met altima. Papi mal, quoi ça qu'on fait, on y parle. Bam tiye, on va on parate. On fait privé, m'pat encore travail. Changez bon tiye, aïe, qu'on paye léon. Voyez tige, sous dix mounes, n'ayo moué quitté. Wadio Gonzalez sorti qui va, pepote yon dans l'opouyo, me travaille la nuit pour la jou, pour l'entourner m'acheter yon tite, yon ti cabrit, yon ti vache, yon ti pousson. J'étampe ma plume dans mon chagrin, bonjour en pile, m'voye pour toute loi, compagne pour balo, a dit combien m'doué, yon jou Gonzalez la caille m'a recevoir, m'ba consigne, wabam, m'a fait yon croix.
That is Martha Jean-Claude and Nostalgie Haïtienne, Nostalgia for Haiti.
Nostalgie Haïtienne.
Haïtienne.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
It's an unusual, sitting here trying to figure out what language that is, whether it was Creole or something else. What is that?
It's Creole, but since Martha lived in Cuba for a very long time and I think spent some time in Mexico, she's singing it with somewhat of a Cuban accent, with a Spanish accent. But it's beautiful. It's really what a parent is dreaming for their child, for their return while they're away.
And you know, this theme seems so important in a lot of Haitian culture. It's in your book, Claire of the Sea Light. I mean, the whole story hinges on whether Claire's dad is going to leave and leave her behind. And for you personally, this song, this story has resonance as well, right?
Well, a lot of our story, especially those of us who are in the diaspora, is a story of migration. And I see myself, in a way, listening to that song on the receiving end of it, because my parents left Haiti, my father when I was 2, my mother when I was 4. And we did go, we had a lot of letters back and forth, cassettes, you know, phone calls. So there was a lot, you know, the parent dreaming of every way to fill that gap, and you're that child receiving it. Just as, you know, Claire's dad feels like he has to go abroad to work. So it's a situation that, unfortunately, a lot of parents and children find themselves in. And that's really so resonates so strongly in this song as well.
Now, how old were you when you followed your parents to the States?
Well, my parents left, as I said, when I was very young, but it took about 8 years for everything to be settled immigration-wise. So I was 12 when I moved to Brooklyn to join them. And by then they'd had 2 other children while they were in the States. My brothers, I had 2 brothers who were born here.
Mm-hmm. And when you came here, did you speak English?
I didn't speak any English. I knew a couple of words because I had an uncle who would do English tapes, but I didn't speak any English. I learned quickly, in part because I was young and I had the U.S.-born brothers, and went to school immediately. So I started speaking pretty soon after I got here.
And when did you start writing?
My first thing was published when I was 14 in New Youth Connections, which is a newspaper that's still published in New York City. And it was about Christmas, how we spend Christmas. So I feel like I was writing even when I was in Haiti, because I loved reading and I loved stories. But my very first published thing was when I was 14.
And was that in English or Creole?
It was in English. It was in English. It was for this newspaper, newspaper here.
So to this day, when you put pen to paper, is it always English? Or, you know, do you think and write in Creole as well?
Well, I think in Creole, but it's just that my writing language became English when I came here at 12, and the way we were living, everybody spoke Creole, but we weren't taught to write Creole at that time, and we wrote French, but we didn't speak it, at least in my home situation. So it was English sort of became the bridge language for me.
Now, we're speaking with Edwige Danticat, the award-winning novelist, MacArthur Fellow. Her new book is called Claire of the Sea Light. We mentioned that there is a radio station in this little fictional town, and you mentioned the hip-hop, you know, tapes, the cassettes that get sent to the guy who runs the show there. Is that style of music commonly heard on the radio in Haiti?
On certain radio stations, but it is a style of music that more and more is reflecting the reality. So you have, you know, you had some groups like King Posse, but the closer, you know, I think hip-hop in so many different societies comes as close as possible to sort of to people who are living a certain reality, and if they're able to get access, can immediately. Mm. It's very hard for literature to do it. Journalism can do it, but it's already filtered through the voice of somebody else, through the journalist. But you have a kind of direct, it's sort of instant poetry in some cases, that's talking about the immediate realities. And I think that's what hip-hop has traveled so far around the world, and in terms of, you'll have from the French, you know, suburbs with kids who feel marginalized through the bidonvilles in Haiti, or in all the different parts of the world. It gives an outlet in the same way that it was able to do here in America when it started.
Well, one thing that has been popular in on the radio in Haiti, popular enough that some of us in the States have actually heard of this band, is Coupe Cloué.
Mm-hmm.
I don't speak Creole, but I understand there's a double entendre somewhere in the name. I'm not going to ask you to explicate that for us, but tell us about the band.
Well, Coupe Cloué is full of double entendre. He's brand of compas, which is a very popular style of music in Haiti. His brand of it was called compas mamba. And compas mamba is spicy, you know, and you could see why. But this particular song, Azu King King, I'd always loved, because it doesn't have as much of the double entendre that he's known for, but it is too a song about exile. It's a song that tells a story. It's this man who is singing to his wife, who's now moved to the U.S., and he's saying to her, well, you know, here women have to work. You can't sit down and just do your nails. I'm going to work. You take care of the children. It's proposing this really new reality to a woman of ease who's used to be comfortable in Haiti, and now she's in New York. And it's framed all around this notion that my parents and a lot of people I know talk about La Vie New York, and there was even a film about it, Life in New York. And when you get here from Haiti, you get a set of rules about La Vie New York. And so this husband, or the man of this woman, is telling her about La Vie New York, and it's not the same as in Haiti where you were Azu King King, you were all fancy. But it's like, here you really have to work hard, lady. That's basically what he's telling her.
This is Coupe Cloué from Haiti with Azu King King.
Ma chaise a pas fait comme ça, la vie nous y a pas la vie facile. Ma travail payé caille, moi démêlé au fait du monde. Na New York pas qu'un gros saison, à ce quelqu'un secret pour la caille. Ma travail payé caille, moi démêlé au fait du monde. Na New York pas qu'un gros saison, à ce quelqu'un secret pour la caille.
So that's music by Coupe Cloué from Haiti, and that song, Azu King King, that's got to be several decades newer than the Marta Jean-Claude song you played for us before.
Yeah, it's definitely more recent. I think that particular one is from the 70s or
okay.
So.
Mm-hmm. So, but the same theme of immigration
yeah.
and
mm-hmm.
making your way, you know, as a family, you know, in different circumstances. Very much a part of your novel, Claire of the Sea Light, the latest from my guest, Edwige Dantica, who's with us here on Soundcheck and sharing a playlist, her pick three. You had, the story goes, multiple possible endings for this novel,
mm-hmm.
And you sort of decided last minute on one of them. Without spoiling it for people who haven't read the book yet, how did you make that decision?
Well, I tried, you know, I tried the worst case scenario in one case, and I had written that one in a shorter version of the story, and then I tried these other endings, but I think part of it too was sometimes when you're working with a character for so long, that character almost becomes a part of your family, and Claire, in a way, became that for me, and I became very attached to her. And I became the parent who had to give her up. And so it was a very hard decision. I think my decision as a writer paralleled in some way what her father had to go through in deciding what to do, you know, with how she would spend the rest of her life.
Now, some of the parts of this novel had been published previously.
Mm-hmm.
So was this a novel from the get-go, or did you write a couple of stories and think, oh, if I stitch these together and take this point of view, I may have something here?
Well, it was a kind of a hybrid from the beginning, something between stories and a novel. And as I mentioned Jean Toomer before, Kane, for example, was a big model for this book, a book like Winesburg, Ohio, where you're getting to know a particular community as part of the book. So it's from the very beginning, it was something in between a traditional novel and a traditional short story collection.
Edwige Dantica is with us on Soundcheck today, and the third of your picks Alex is someone that we've come to know on Soundcheck over the years. Emmeline Michel.
Yes, Emmeline Michel, who's also a very good friend of mine. Her latest album, Quintessence, is absolutely extraordinary. This song is called Merci la vie, and it brings us fully post-earthquake. And I know, because I worked with Emmeline a little bit on this album, full disclosure.
In what capacity?
We worked in a song together called A Dawn that's on the album.
Ah.
And so...
Do you sing on that?
I don't sing. I speak.
But that you didn't pick that one for us.
No, I wanted to pick this the one that would close with such healing. It's called Merci la vie, thank you life, and it's really it brings us to this post earthquake moment, this moment of looking back, but also a moment of gratitude. And Emmeline, as you know, because she's been on your show, she's considered, you know, she's often called the queen of Haitian music, the Joni Mitchell of Haiti, and combines all these elements of, you know, of Martha Jean-Claude, some elements of Martha's style, but also with compa, rara, jazz, pop. And Merci la vie, you know, starts with saying, I see the sun bathing, you know, and it echoes this thing also in Haitian folklore, la reine soleil levée, the queen of the rising sun, which is a symbol of hope. So it's really saying, thank you for my breath, thank you for my life. It's a song about gratitude, about the people, you know, the people we who have survived this extraordinary moment of our history, while at the same time sort of acknowledging the fact that we have lost people.
Well, we'll hear the song from Emmeline Michel, but before we do, Edwige Dantecas, the book is called Claire of the Sea Light. I really enjoyed reading this book, and great to have you with us here in the Soundcheck studio. Thanks so much.
Thank you for having me.
Merci pour voir qui ka parlé tout ça non moins pas cassé vous aurez moins qui attendait yo femme qui besoin parler le problème yo vle voter merci pour moun qui pas juger ban moi l'amour là yo croisé toujours vini pour yon bravo là l'homme pe di adresse mon lovan yo a plié un jour moi rien je me crier Pense à la vie m'a déployé. Qu'il y a raison pour m'd'appeler. Mais puis tout m'compte tout ça m'gagne. Des fois m'bite m'de gringolé. Mais l'homme tombe toujours levé. Sous des pieds moins qui pote moins. Côté tout sous l'eau à couler.
Up next, more from the singer Laura Mvula here in the Soundcheck studio. Stay with us.
Take me outside. Sit in the green garden, nobody out there, but it's okay now. Bathing the sunlight, don't mind if rain falls. Take me outside, sit in the green garden.
This is Soundcheck, I'm John Schaefer. British singer Laura Mvula has garnered comparisons to Adele and Amy Winehouse, and sure, she does have that retro soul thing going on, but what puts Laura Mvula's debut album, Sing to the Moon, in its own category is what's added to that soulful sound, namely lush orchestrations, carefully crafted layers of vocals, and tight, jazzy harmonies. We'll talk with Laura in just a moment, but first, let's hear some music. This is Laura Mvula with her trio playing a stripped-down acoustic set live in the Soundcheck studio and a song called Father, Father.
Father, Father, let me love you. Saw you wandering in my dream last night, singing. Wonder, wonder what you might do. You can't simply hide a dream in the blue. Don't try to fight, don't let me go. You've gone too far from what I know. I lost my heart in the dark.
with you. Father, Father, by let me go. Father, please don't let me go. Brother, brother, let me love you. Whisper your dear best fears. You can trust me, and when it's over, we can be green. Finally, let's make amends. Try to save it. Don't try to fight. Don't let me go. You've gone too far from what I know. I lost my heart in the dark with you. Father, Father, why let me go? Father, please don't let me go. Let me love you. 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 Don't try to fight. Don't let me go. You've gone too far from what I know. I lost my heart in the dark with you. Father, Father, why let me go, Father? Father, please don't let me go. Father, Father, why you let me go? Father, please don't let me go. Father, Father, why? Father, please don't let me go. Father, Father, why you let me go?
That is Laura Mvula, live in the Soundcheck studio with her song called Father, Father. Laura, welcome to the program.
Hello.
And let me introduce the rest of your band. Your sister, Dion Douglas, on violin, and your brother, James Douglas, playing the cello. Laura playing the keyboard. So you guys could do like a little Schubert trio here if the mood struck
Schubert?
You.
I'm not sure. Maybe Haydn.
Maybe a Haydn trio, yeah. So are you all classically trained? Was that in the family?
Yes. Me to a more basic level. But James and Dion are much more advanced than I. Hence why there's not a violin in my hand, even though I used to play.
Really?
Right.
Okay. But you also studied, obviously, piano.
That's right.
Did you study singing as well? Did you do classical singing at all?
No. Singing started for me when I started touring around with my auntie's a cappella group, Black Voices.
Mm-hmm.
And they sang a lot of different styles, reggae, soul music, jazz, some folk arrangements, And I was captivated by their sound, five-part harmony, and they covered such a range. And sometimes they'd even imitate instruments with their voices.
Mm-hmm.
And I copied and asked when I was about 16 if I could join the group, and I was allowed to come on tour.
Well, that's got to be great training, you know, because you're completely exposed as a singer.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, it was amazing for me to go to all those different places and to be given a platform for the first time. It was super hard for me. I found, like you say, it was so, a cappella music can be so exposing. And the part I was singing was alto, and that was often the lead vocal. And oftentimes I wasn't quite confident enough, but I was given room to grow. So I owe a lot to that time.
Yeah. So how did you go from the a cappella group and the classical piano training into, I'm going to say retro soul because everyone's
That's
using
fine.
That, but you know what I mean?
You
know, how did that happen, that move?
I'm not really sure. During university, I put a group together that I guess you could say was like a soul or a neo-soul experiment. But it really was an experiment on my part. I was leading it, but I was quite a feeble, again, quite a feeble singer. But I had these ideas that I wanted to share, and I had six friends that were willing to, and James and Dion were in the band as well.
Mm-hmm.
And so we toured locally in Birmingham, where we grew up. And from there, I don't know, I had an interest in being on the stage a little bit. And then when the band disbanded, I decided I needed to be creative on my own. And I wasn't sure what that would be or what it would sound like. But I started what I would call song sketching, which was just me with my laptop and a keyboard and a microphone. And I found that I enjoyed layering up my voice.
Yeah.
That became the hobby.
Yeah.
And from there, the songs grew.
We're speaking with Laura Mvula. Her album is called Sing to the Moon. It is out now. And it really puts to good use all of these different musical ideas, these different musical worlds we've been talking about.
I hope so.
You've got like what sounds like a pretty full orchestra.
Tricked you. Yeah, we actually recorded the album in a room probably a quarter of the size of this room, which it was a tiny studio. So in order to get the orchestral sound or to try to achieve it, we used a string quartet plus a double bass at times. And just try to layer up the sound pretty much the same way I did with my voice to make a choir, which is fun, and of course it's much cheaper that way.
Right, right. And you have four or five very tired musicians.
That's
by
correct.
The end of the day.
Very smelly, yeah.
So you did all the arranging yourself?
That's right. Steve Brown, who produced the record, kind of came on board after he'd heard She and Green Garden. And actually hadn't written more once he'd heard those. He said, you should continue writing. And I did. He was really encouraging. And from there, we built up this Sing to the Moon album, which kind of feels like a happy accident.
Well, and includes both of those songs you mentioned, She and Green Garden, which is the one we heard a little bit of as we were beginning here. It also includes this song Diamond, which you guys are going to play for us next, in this kind of chamber music setting, you know, this kind of piano, violin, cello thing. So,
yeah.
All in the family.
Absolutely.
Let's hear it. It's Laura Mvula with her sister and brother, Dion and James Douglas, playing the string instruments live on Soundcheck with a song called Diamond.
Sometimes the grass seems greener on the other side. Place
you got the moon under your feet. You got the moon in your heart. Waiting for a day of change to come. Dancing in a gloomy storm, dancing, dancing.
That is Laura Mvula live on Soundcheck with Dion and James Douglas on violin and cello, respectively. The three siblings performing a song called Diamond. And you'll find a version of that on Laura Mvula's record called Sing to the Moon, which is out now. So, Laura, you sounded almost surprised earlier when you were talking about how this record came together. Mm-hmm. You know, it was sort of like, wow, now I have a record.
Yes.
What do you do for an encore? Are you working on more songs?
No. We're still bang in the middle of a really exciting time touring. The live setup is so it's such a challenge, but in a good way, you know.
Yeah.
There were 22 musicians on the record, and I tour with a six-piece band, and everybody sings. So, you know, each place we play, we experience something new. And my sound team are also amazing. You know, there's a lot going on.
So there's a lot going on, yeah.
But I have done some writing projects recently, not in album form, but I've written some music for a documentary that's coming out, and a couple of other things and collaborations with other artists coming up.
Very nice. Well, and the tour, you know, you've got your brother and sister in the band with you, so that's nice.
Yeah,
and
for now.
Wow. Good thing this interview is ending. Who knows where that would lead. Laura, I know that this is a rare day off during this busy tour. I am really glad that the three of you came in to play for
you.
Us today.
It's a pleasure.
Nothing less but memories. The best ones seem to go by slow. Try to write the perfect song for you. Then I realized it didn't belong to me. It didn't belong.
Don't forget that every weekday at 2 p.m. Eastern, you can listen to live tapings happening here in our studio tomorrow at 2 on soundcheck.org. Hear the theatrical British electropop artist and producer Ebony Bones playing a live set of her latest songs. That's tomorrow, 2 p.m. on soundcheck.org. Coming up on the show, we'll look at how we determine what's popular these days and what that word even means anymore. That's next on Soundcheck. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. What is popular? Used to be that we could measure what is popular in music by the Billboard chart. Yes, one chart. Nowadays, not so simple. Adam Sternberg is culture editor for the New York Times Magazine. His recent cover story explored how we determine what is popular and the new and kind of slippery definitions of what popular means. Adam joins us from the offices of the New York Times. Adam Sternberg, welcome to Soundcheck.
Hi, thank you.
So what does it, I mean, our definition has had to change of what popular is because these days everything can be popular.
Yeah, definitely. You know, we started from this idea that I think is pretty well established now, that we're all very fractured in terms of how we consume culture, and we don't necessarily all listen to the same music, watch the same TV shows. You know, the cultural universe has sort of expanded very dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
But then within that, we wondered, well, why are there certain things that continue to be popular? And what does it mean when there are things that are very popular to one group of people that another group hasn't even heard of? And that's something that, you know, I think happens more and more now.
So there's this kind of balkanization of our of what was once a common culture in America.
Yeah. In fact, the genesis of the idea for the whole package in some ways came out of this conversation we were having in the office about this television show, Duck Dynasty, which has become very popular. It draws over 10 million viewers and you know, its ratings are higher than a lot of very famous, well-known network TV shows. And the office was really split between people who watched Duck Dynasty and loved it and people who had literally never heard of it.
Hmm.
And we thought, okay, something interesting is going on here.
Folks, I'm Phil Robertson, and I hunt ducks for a living. I have a God-given right to pursue happiness. My idea of happiness is killing things, skinning them, plucking them, have a big meal, all your children, your grandchildren gather around, and we eat that.
Yuppie girls wouldn't like it. Don't marry some yuppie girl. Find you a meek, gentle, kind-spirited country girl. If she knows how to cook, and she carries her Bible and lives by it, and she loved to eat bullfrogs, now there's a woman.
So if Duck Dynasty is pulling in more than 10 million viewers, how do we compare its popularity, Adam, to something like Mad Men with a quarter of that viewership, or to something like Girls, which has less than a million viewers?
Well, this was kind of the question of the whole package, was that maybe we need to rethink what popularity means or what the different meanings it can have now. Because certainly there's one way of looking at popularity, which is just by the sheer numbers. What is the movie that the most people went to see? What is the TV show that the most people sit down and watch? But there's also this sense of popularity in which, you know, to what extent does something sort of infiltrate the cultural conversation? How often do you see the stars on magazine covers? How often do people talk about the show? I mean, certainly a show like Girls is a very dramatic example of a show that's, in sheer numbers, the viewership is really quite small, but it's certainly a show that has worked its way into people's consciousness completely outsized to its actual viewership.
Yeah.
So it seems like you're measuring two separate things now.
Right. So is Girls popular?
I think it's really popular. But, of course, I live in New York City where the show is set, and I'm squarely in the demographic of HBO. And I think HBO is actually a very interesting example as a network because they operate by a different model than the broadcast networks. They don't sell advertising, so they can afford to think about popularity in a different way. And I know that they put a lot more credence into the idea of buzz, for lack mm-hmm. of a better word, mm-hmm. and also, you know, the extent to which a show wins awards and it just has a certain sheen of quality to it. Whereas if you work at CBS, for example, you're basically looking at a bottom line of how many people watched the show last night and how can we sell them to our advertisers.
We're speaking with Adam Sternberg, the culture editor of the New York Times Magazine. His recent piece is called What It Means to Be Popular When Everything is Popular. if we look at the Billboard charts, you know, you make the point that originally there was just a single chart. It told you how many records were being sold, you know, which were the big sellers. Nowadays, those charts have changed to accommodate things like first radio broadcasts and later downloads and streams and finally even YouTube views. So the meaning of those charts has changed and the kinds of things that we find at the top of those charts has changed with it, right?
Yeah, I think the history of Billboard charts and music charts in general is a really fascinating example of a measurement that's trying to evolve and keep up with the way in which people experience music. And I think when Billboard first, for example, included things like streams or downloads, those kind of made sense. You know, you want to know how many people are downloading a song from iTunes, for example, as opposed to buying it in a store.
Mm-hmm.
But then this year, they started to include the number of times people watch or listen to a song on YouTube. And it resulted in this song, Harlem Shake, which was part of this big viral video craze, suddenly becoming the number one song in America and going to the top of the Billboard chart. And I think most people would look at that and say, wait a second, this seems a little off. It seems like this chart is not properly measuring popularity anymore.
Well, it certainly wasn't measuring popularity in terms of sheer numbers of records sold. But man, this song was everywhere earlier this year, The Harlem Shake by Bauer. Harlem Shake. Little bit of Bauer's Harlem Shake, which became a viral video sensation to the point that it became, for a brief period of time, the number one song in the country on the Billboard charts. Does that mean it was popular, Adam Sternberg?
Well, it's funny listening to it now again. I realize it is kind of an awesome song. But it's funny. There are 8 bars of that song that every person in America who owns a computer could repeat back to you, which are, you know, but then the rest of the song, I don't think anyone knows what's going to happen. Are there lyrics? Is there a verse coming? You know, in a sense, that snippet of that song will exist in our minds 20 years from now as a relic of 2013, much in the same way that like a number one Beach Boys song from the 1960s represents a certain time and place. But I think, you know, in the effort to measure popularity, it just shows you all the different factors now that you have to consider. It's not just how many people walked into a record store and handed over their money for a record. It's how many people stuck 8 bars of a song into a goofy video they made with their friends, and then how many people watched that.
Right. And if, 100 million people watched it, I mean, this is the thing with YouTube views. You cannot assume that 100 million Americans know that song, because those 100 million views may be, you know, 10 million people watching it 10 times each. And, you know, it's sort of, so it's not like sales where people don't go and buy 10 copies of a record because they like it so much.
Yeah, and it's actually a really interesting example of how we experience music now and how it's changed. Once upon a time, the number one song, you know, the most distinctive thing about it would be how many times you might hear it come on the radio just over and over again. But now, if there's a song you like, you can sit at your computer and just listen to it over and over again. And so I think it creates these outsized hits like this song, like Gangnam Style,
mm-hmm.
that song
mm-hmm.
by Psy, which was so huge. And yet, in a weird way, I don't feel like Gangnam Style will persist in our cultural memory in the way that some other huge number one hit songs have, though I could be wrong.
Now, what about this? You write about the truism that if something is popular, it can't also be good. In a fractured cultural landscape, does that still hold true?
I don't think it does. And I think that thinking is sort of out of date now. And I included that in the article because literally one of my colleagues had sort of reacted to the idea of a package about popularity by saying, oh, great, everything we're going to focus on is going to be terrible.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when popularity was simply a measure of the massive amount of people that liked something, we got this idea that popularity equaled lowest common denominator, that nothing interesting or challenging or prickly or inventive could ever ascend to the number one position. I don't think that's true at all anymore. And in fact, because there's so many little micro categories of popularity now, seeking out the most popular thing in a different niche category can really expose you to a lot of interesting things you wouldn't find otherwise.
You can read Adam Sternberg's article, What It Means to Be Popular When Everything is Popular, in the most recent installment of the New York Times Magazine, where Adam is the culture editor. It's a really fun article, Adam, covering lots of different parts of our culture, and I enjoyed reading it. Thanks for sharing it with us today.
Thanks for having me.
You are the popular one, the popular chick. It is what it is, now popular is.
Standing on the field with your pretty pom-pom. Now you're working at the movie selling popular corn. I could have been a mess, but I never went wrong, because I'm putting down my story in a popular song.
A little bit of popular song. That's the name of it, from the British songwriter Mika with singer Ariana Grande. With a YouTube video count at 26 million views, we'd say this song is, yeah, pretty popular. That's going to do it for Soundcheck today. Tomorrow on the show, the prolific actor Harry Dean Stanton has appeared in over 200 films, including big screen epics like Cool Hand Luke and cult favorites like Pretty in Pink. We'll talk about his lifelong passion for music and his recent starring role as the subject of a new documentary, Harry Dean Stanton, Partly Fiction. Plus, there's still one tale left to tell about the Beatles. It's about their longtime secretary, Frida Kelly. She joins us, along with the director of the new documentary, Good Old Frida. And Deer Tick's alt-country sound takes on a darker, almost punky edge in their new album, whose title, Negativity, is both a warning and a lure. They'll play live. Our theme song is from New York keyboardist Marco Benevento. It's called Eagle Rock, and you can find out more info than you would ever want to know about Marco and his music on our website, soundcheck.org. I'm John Schaefer. Thanks for being with us. Join us tomorrow night at 9 for another Soundcheck.